Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, a podcast where we talk about the chiclet that made us who we are. My name is Carrie O'Donoghue and I'm a novelist, a journalist, and someone who has locked her four illegitimate but charming children in the attic above your grandmother's house. Today, I've invited author Julie Cohen to talk the 1979 gothic horror classic Flowers in the Attic. Julie, welcome to the podcast and to my childhood.
Hello, Caroline, and welcome to my teenage years.
When I DM'd you to ask if you wanted to be on the podcast, because I've, you know, seen you on Twitter for a long time and really interested in what's in that whole head of yours, and then you said Flowers in the Attic, yeah. I just transcended my body.
Because I didn't discover a lot of the chiclet that you talk about until I was much older, in my 20s, mm-hmm. and at university. When I was at school, this was what we read, Flowers in the Attic.
Oh, yeah.
We
yeah.
passed it around. I read that in Stephen King, and we passed it around, and page 355 turned down so that we could read it under the table in Miss Wood's English class.
So I'm a little bit younger than you are, but this came out, the heyday, this was the 80s really, came out in 1979, but then it just sort of passed between girls in this very sacred way. So because I went to school, you know, in secondary school in the 2000s, I was the person who introduced this into my class.
Oh, you're so cool.
I was patient zero. Flowers in the Attic, because my sister, who's 10 years older than me, she had read it and she'd passed it on. And I remember that moment of her giving me this book clearer than any book memory ever. Like she walked into my room with the book behind her back and she pulled it out and she was like, "You need to read this." And I was like, "Shut up." And she was like, no. And then I read, and it just like everything, my whole life pivoted on that moment. I feel like every single thing I've written since then has been informed of Flowers in the Attic.
I think everything I've written has been informed by Flowers in the Attic too.
And I mean, both of us have the same edition in front of us. Disappointingly, we have the new edition that doesn't have the famous inlay of the kids behind the attic window, which many people remember. But it has a quote from Gillian Flynn on the front saying, "I will probably be clutching Flowers in the Attic in my gnarled hands on my deathbed." That is the author of Gone Girl.
Yeah.
And it completely makes sense, right?
It does. I have this theory that women's fiction sort of comes down in three strands. And like there's one strand that comes from Jane Austen, uh-huh. which is, a lot of the chiclet you've been talking about.
Right.
And especially like Bridget Jones' Diary.
Sure.
There's another strand that comes from the Brontes, which this comes from. But actually even before the Brontes, from the Gothic novel tradition, which went down to the Brontes. And then this is such a Gothic Bronte-ish novel.
That is completely correct.
And
oh, my God.
And that has gone to domestic noir
yeah.
in our current publishing.
Yeah, because Flowers in the Attic has drafted down into noir, like Gone Girl and Girl on the Train, that kind of thing. What's the third strand?
The third strand is more literary fiction, like George Eliot. So more sort of
Middlemarch and
so more social realism.
Well, okay, I'm going to go into the plot summary before we go too far down that road, because already my mind is blown and we're like 3.5 minutes into recording. So, I mean, it's a very confusing, unwieldy plot, and I've tried to condense it as much as I can into this sort of paragraph. Just so you know, we always talk about, for listeners, we always talk about spoilers on Sentimental Garbage. That's kind of the thing. But for this book in particular, a lot of the reading it is in the twists and the momentum. So I would really recommend, if you're going to read one book before, you know, because lots of people listen and then they read, but this is the one you want to read first and then come back and listen. So go away and come back.
Also, trigger warnings too, I think, with this book.
Trigger warnings.
It has some very dark things in it.
Yeah, sexual violence, rape, murder, like it's all there. So yeah, there are some caveats on this episode. And now I'm going to go into the plot summary.
Dun, dun, dun.
So we meet the Dahlengangers. The Dahlengangers are this perfect, loving family from Pennsylvania in the 50s. And it's all told through this narrator who is Kathy. She's 12 years old. She wants to be a ballerina. She comes from this loving family. She's got her older brother, Chris, who's 14. Her younger siblings, who are Corey and Carrie, they're these twins. And they are, I think, 6 at the beginning of the book. And then she has these parents, these beautiful blonde parents, who are just completely obsessed with each other. And it's all very lovely. One day, this loveliness is shattered when her father, who travels a lot for work, is killed in a road accident. And then it is revealed to the children that Corinne, their mother, has no marketable skills. and they're also very in debt. All of their stuff is bought on credit. And she says to them, I have nothing. We have nothing. The only hope we have is that my family, who disinherited me when I was a teenager, are very wealthy, and we're going to go back and win our way back into that fortune. She then reveals the reason that she was disinherited was because she eloped with her half-uncle, who was the children's father, who now dead, and in order to sort of win back the very religious parents who saw this union as being sacrilegious, she has to pretend she never had children. And in order to do that, she has to lock them in the attic of her childhood home, which is this huge, sprawling southern mansion called Foxworth Hall. And there they stay for the duration of this book, which...
3 years.
3 years. All right, did I leave anything out?
Well, there's a lot that happens in that attic.
There's a heck of a lot. I'm going to take a long sip of my tea before we get into the heck of a lot.
But my literary theory for this book, you're just giving that. I mean, we've got Wuthering Heights in there. We've got Jane Eyre. There's a lot of tropes that come from Bronte novels in this book, which are fantastic.
I have the never
four children
made that
in the
connection
attic
before.
And the mad woman in the attic.
Yes, the sort of the idea that you can put your problem somewhere, you know, and that you can control people as if they're resources, and that if you just sort of... Because it's very clear that the reason she does this is because she's genuinely destitute and she has nothing. She feels like there's nothing else she can do. But the most chilling thing about the novel is that slowly this mother who did this thing out of desperation, who you feel like the family are the unit and she's just doing her best, she becomes lured away by wealth, by romance, by travel, and she gradually forgets these children and turns on them, and they turn on her, and it becomes this war, really.
Yeah, and she becomes evil. And actually, I was reading this, and it's right at the midpoint that it happens.
Literally
that you discover,
the smack middle.
Literally at the midpoint, you discover that Corinne has turned against her children.
Okay, give me a little reading.
It's when she slaps Christopher. Moving swiftly and with strong purpose, Mama reached his side. Her hand lifted and she delivered a hard, stinging slap against his cheek with an exclamation point. There are a lot of exclamation points in this book.
Yeah, there's a ton of them. Yeah.
Then, before he could recover from the shock of that, her left hand lifted and the opposite cheek felt the strength of her anger! Exclamation point. And that is when we know that she has turned against, because Christopher was always her golden boy.
Yes. So this book is very famous for the incestuous relationship that occurs between Kathy and Chris. So they're put in this attic. They're at these very, you know, pivotal ages for sexual development. Mm-hmm. She's 12, he's 14. They start to develop. They start to have to parent their own siblings. Mm-hmm. And they sort of adopt this kind of like, we're a family. This is what we do. I pretend to be the mom. You pretend to be the dad. And it's like a coping mechanism. But then this sort of gets confused. All they have is each other. And then they end up in love, really.
Yeah.
In a very romantic, sexual, yet very safe and trusting love that also includes a very shocking rape scene.
Yes.
That I think is what everyone remembers the most about this book.
That's what everybody remembers, is that page, which happens quite close to the end.
Yeah. Yeah, it is not just a book about like two siblings falling in love. It is very much a book about family and the traps of that, and it's all through this gothic lens. But really, because from page one, there is kind of an incesty vibe.
Oh, not even kind of. Not even kind of. So on page 11, when the father is still alive, I was reading this, I was going, oh my God, I didn't realize this, because I read it when I was 12, 13, and I didn't even notice. But when the father's still alive, the mother's about to have the twins, and Kathy is worried that her dad won't love her as much.
Yes, I also flagged this.
And he brings her a little ring with a stone in it, and he gives it to her, and he says, and with this ring, I do vow to forever love my Kathy just a little bit more than any other daughter.
That is fucking creepy.
It is so creepy, and it's even creepier when you realize what happened, what he did to Corinne, because he met her when she was 14.
And he was 18.
He was 17, 18,
yeah.
But he groomed her until she was 18 and could run away with him. I mean, that is child abuse, what he did with
her. Yeah.
It's not just incest, it's child abuse. And he's doing the same thing to his daughter.
And it's this weird thing, because when I read this as a kid, I took it at face value of like, oh, you know, they had this beautiful, I think this wonderful, handsome father, and everyone's always talking about how handsome and wonderful and smart he is and yeah. how good he is at his job. But like the way he sort of like demands physical affection from everybody, like he comes through the door every day, he goes on these long business trips and he comes back saying, come greet me with kisses if you love me.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a fucking weird way to greet your kids.
And gives them presents. And that's yeah. the sort of exchange in this book is money for love and love for money.
Yes.
This book is
yes.
about money and love. And the material sort of belongings in this book are described with such passion. It's when I was talking about this book with somebody who'd read it before, I was like, it is really weird because this book makes child abuse aspirational.
It does make child abuse aspirational.
In a really, really bizarre way. And actually, before we go any further with talking about how problematic this book is, I want to say very, very clearly that women are allowed to have whatever fantasy they want. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that wholeheartedly. Like, yeah. I think there are a lot of really problematic ideas in this book. But I loved it as a kid.
And I still love it.
And we should be allowed to love it no matter how problematic it is, don't you
yeah,
think?
No, I completely agree. And I read something that I had never thought about before about this book, about why so many teenage girls loved this and found it sexy, you mm-hmm. know? And it's not because there were all these teenage girls who wanted to kiss their brothers. It was because they wanted to feel their sexuality in like a safe way, and
yes.
what's safer than your own family, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah, that's interesting.
The way they talk about
their love too is always in a fairy tale. They use fairy tale language
yes.
for each other, so it's even
yes.
safer.
Yeah, it's very much caught up in these games and narratives that they invent to survive this terrible life that they have. And I feel like I will never know a fictional place the way I know that attic in that bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
So the format is very much, like, there's like this tiny, it's a good-sized bedroom with these two double beds and all this heavy furniture and an ensuite bath, a long staircase, and then this enormous attic that you just can see going on forever and ever and ever, right? And then a little schoolroom off the attic, and it's like, mm-hmm. I know it better than I know the Anne Frank annex, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah.
just so in my head, and I think that's a huge part of why it works so well, because I don't know, you just know that world so well. I think it's a very basic thing to say, obviously, but yeah.
But also, it's, so I'm going all English lit major here, right?
Yeah.
So it's also the brain. So, you know, whenever you talk about an attic in a book, it's usually the psyche of somebody. So they've got
right.
this sort of very, they've got the public facing sort of place where they have to be good and they're not allowed to touch each other and they have
yes.
to sleep separately and the grandmother can come in at any minute and watch them and they have to keep it clean and tidy. And then they have this attic where they're allowed to roam free. They can, you know, free being as free as they can be, but they can decorate it however they want. That's where the sexual encounter happens. That's where so many things happen that are really important to
yeah.
their development. And then Chris and Kathy have a roof where they can go out together, which is
yeah.
their sort of adult space,
because yeah.
the children are too scared to go there. So it's almost like a symbol of their development. It's very strange.
I never thought about that way, but you're completely correct. Yeah, everything interesting happens in that attic, and
yeah.
which is why it's, you know, it's flowers in the attic and not flowers in the spare bedroom ensuite, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah. And also how a book that's really set in a small space. I mean, when you're writing a book, it's hard to set a book in a really, really tiny space,
mm-hmm.
a one-room thing. But this works really well. And you feel that it's confined because they're stuck there
yeah.
and powerless. But you also feel that they've made this realm where they
and
are.
It's so rich with fantasy. And she dances up there and, you know, and Corey plays music up there and they have plays. And
mm-hmm.
and you're right, they do use all the sort of fairy tale language. And also there's like There's kind of stacks and stacks of trunks and old clothing and broken vitriolas and stuff. And they literally pull out Confederate and Yankee sort of uniforms. And it's like all the family secrets are locked in this attic.
Yeah.
So, and they are the family secret.
Yeah, they are.
And they're also up there. And it's fantastic. I'm sorry. I just keep going back to, and it's fucking fantastic.
It's just great. I mean, it could lag in the middle, but it doesn't. And there's some sort of quiet bits in the middle. They spend a lot of time talking about adolescence and the changes that their body makes, which is maybe why it's so fascinating to young girls, this book.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of stuff about periods and Chris has wet dreams and there's that, you know, she talks about her boobs coming out and the hairs. Oh, and there's this one bit where she sits and plucks out all the hairs that are coming.
And it's quite sweet, you know.
Yeah. But it's weird.
But like, it's like it's got that kind of thing of like, wherever you are, no matter what your situation is, these things are unavoidable. You can't stop them or wish them away. And the mother basically does try to wish them away. So she comes with presents to sort of assuage her guilt that she's completely forgotten about her own children. And she'll go to Europe for 3 months and then come back and be like, I know you've been locked up here, but I bought you this velvet gown.
Yeah, which doesn't fit which anymore doesn't fit she because she doesn't know that they've grown up.
Yeah, and she refuses to acknowledge that they are growing. And even at one point, it's a very traumatic part of the book, Kathy is punished for looking at her own body, looking at her naked body, by her grandmother. And her punishment is that her hair is tarred while she's asleep. She has beautiful, long, blonde hair that has it comes back to a lot. The blondness of these kids comes back to a lot. And they have to cut off her hair, basically, to save it. And he uses his chemistry set to make a solution to get the tar. It's very traumatic for her because it's her last kind of thing. It's the last thing that she has. And then she has to cut her hair and it looks awful. It's just like this weird hacked up fringe and stuff. And her mom kind of comes back in and she goes, oh, Kathy, how practical of you to cut your hair short. And it's just completely, she doesn't engage with their lives at all. And I think that's like, I'm sorry, I'm sort of railroading a little bit here, but I think it speaks so much to how trapped teenage girls feel by their mothers.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing of wanting to rattle your parent and being like, I'm not a baby anymore. And that's sort of an operatic version of this here, right?
It is. Yeah, it is. And Kathy is the rebellious one, which I think is interesting too. So yeah. Chris is the mummy's boy. He's the good one. Whereas she's the one who says, I always see the bad side of everything. Yeah. I want to. And I could really identify with that because that's, you know, the way I was in my family, right?
Right. What's your family setup?
Oh, my family setup is not Gothic at all. So, you know, my parents were not related to each other.
No, really? I didn't know that families came that way.
And I never had anything going with my brother. But I do think the thing about Gothic is that it is sort of normal tensions and usually family tensions, but just writ large. It's your normal sort of development. Mm-hmm. Just exaggerated to an extent where it becomes horrifying.
Right.
Does that make sense?
You know, it completely makes sense. And when I said earlier on how I feel like everything I've ever written has fallen out of the attic, essentially.
Yeah.
That's what I did with my first book. It was like, I want somebody, the plot is somebody's having this affair and sort of loses themselves in it, but she literally does, like her hair falls out. And I was reading back and it's about like her body wasting away. And this book is just about their bodies wasting.
Yeah.
Throughout these years they spend, like, that is why it never lags, I think, is because even though their days are very samey and you get it sort of lulled into the lullaby of like, and then we wake up at this time and then we do this and then we do this and then the twins go to bed and then we go on the roof and blah, blah, blah. Their mental attitudes and their physical bodies are wasting and changing. So we meet Kathy at the beginning and she's like, she is a little bit rebellious. She's kind of like this rambunctious sort of smart talking kid with loads of big dreams and whatever. And she's very relatable in that way. But she talks in this like kind of weird 50s patter. It's like, golly lolly mama. And it's so wholesome. It's so like bread and cheese. And then her sort of interior monologue goes from like, oh gosh, isn't life crazy, to like, my mother is a poison witch and everyone on earth is hideous and God doesn't exist.
Yes, although her view of men is very different. So one of the things I've noticed about this, which really struck me reading it now, which didn't strike me when I was reading it as a teenager, is how it's only the women who are evil.
Yes. And which might explain why Gillian Flynn likes it so much.
But the men do really bad things, but they are never, ever held accountable.
Never. That is so true.
Yeah. So the grandfather is the person who caused all this problem, but he doesn't even appear in the
book. He's not a character,
really. They see him from above, but that's it. He never really appears. The really evil ones are the mother and the grandmother. And even when Chris rapes Kathy, she immediately forgives him and says, it was my fault, immediately. The uncle, the half-uncle father.
Yeah, who groomed a 14-year-old.
Who groomed a 14-year-old and then is doing really the same thing to his own child, is a god. She sees him as a god on earth. And so it's the men, while being terrible in this book,
right?
get such
With
an
perhaps
easy
the
time
exception
of it.
Of
Corey,
of
who gets to die. Poor Corey.
Spoiler, Corey dies. And this is a massive spoiler, which is Corey's death. So the big climax of the book really is they get sicker and sicker. Corey, who kind of has always had a weak constitution, these two twins, Carrie is the girl and she's sort of very bossy and a real little madam from the beginning and never really stops being one. And then Corey is sort of the sensitive one. He's like, he wets the bed a lot. He needs hay fever shots, but he can't get them because he's in the attic. And then he gets sickest of all. And eventually they sort of demand their mother, you have to take him to the hospital. You can't ignore us anymore. You can't do this anymore. She takes him to the hospital and she comes back 2 days later to say Corey died.
But she doesn't take him to the hospital.
No. Nope.
And then you find out, oh my God, in the film, you find out that she didn't even bury him. She put him in a trunk.
Yeah.
Because they find him in Petals on the Wind.
Oh, my. Petals on the Wind, which is the sequel. The way you said that, Petals on the Wind.
It's like, oh, my God.
I've talked too much, but you tell me about why Corey died.
So Corey dies. They find out later that Corey dies through a bit of nice, convenient sort of overhearing, I think.
Mm-hmm. A lot of convenient overhearing.
Yes. They find out that the powdered donuts that they've been given for months now were coated not with powdered sugar but with arsenic, with rat poison. And because Corey was the smallest of them, he's the one who got the sickest. But they've all been getting sick. And they assume that it's the grandmother who is sending them up. But then they find out that it was actually the mother who was poisoning her own children, which is just terrible. It's all real Greek tragedy stuff.
Oh, yeah. Everybody dies. It's like Les Miserables. It's like Greek tragedy. Like even like the mother says offhandedly at the beginning of the book, and my two brothers who died in road accidents. Like people constantly die in road accidents in Virginia Andrews books. But yeah, no, I think that twist was one of those like, but you've already had a brother and sister who are like in love with each other or whatever, and you think that's going to be the main thing, and then literally in the last 20 pages you're like, and the mother's been killing you the whole time. And I think we find out in later books when Corinne, because there are four books in the series, Corinne explains that her plan was to get them a little bit sick, smuggle them out to a safe house, and then set up a life for them there.
Right.
Do you believe that?
I don't believe that.
You believe that she was murderous?
Yes.
Yeah,
she was just trying to get rid of them because people are evil in this book. Women are evil in this book. Women.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
there was something that occurred to me on my way here was I was thinking about the men and the women in this book and why women love this book so much. And I think maybe one of the reasons is because the women are the ones who have all the agency in this book.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
They, you know, they do all the good things and they do – there aren't that many good things, but they do all the bad things too.
Yeah.
And the men are sort of wishy-washy.
Yeah, there's Bart, who's their new stepfather. So halfway through the book, Corinne remarries and neglects to tell tell her new handsome lawyer husband that she has four children slowly dying.
And the only time he appears in the book is trying to have sex with Corinne. They watch her. And one moment where Kathy escapes and leaves the room to – they're trying to get money so they can escape. And she goes to try to get some money, steal some money from her mother's room. And her stepfather is asleep there.
Yes.
Beautiful with a mustache. His mustache is quite – lovingly described, and he's lying there asleep like Sleeping Beauty, and she walks up like the prince and kisses him.
Right,
and he has a dream about this later on, which directly leads to Christopher getting angry and raping Kathy, because he overhears the dream and that Kathy has kissed another man.
Yeah,
and he says, "Oh, you could get us caught, and also you're mine," and he then rapes her, but. He's a strange character. Again, he does nothing. He's just this passive guy.
He's a total patsy, yeah.
And also men are driven by sex in this book. So Chris and Bart, is his name Bart? He's such a non-entity.
Yeah.
I don't even remember his name. But men are driven by sex. But they can't help it.
No, they can't. No, and it's sort of up to women to sort of, to sort of rule that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Men are driven by sex and women are driven by things.
Yeah.
Because Corinne's sort of ever expanding array of jewelry and clothes is always described. And she has this bedroom, which again is a bedroom I'm never going to forget in my entire life. She has this huge swan bed that used to belong to a French courtesan, which makes no sense in this like Bible bashing household.
Yeah.
But yet she has it. And just like gown after gown, mink after mink. And also she keeps up this insane pretends to them that she's going to secretarial school every day so she can acquire some skills so they can like flee the attic. And it's so heartbreaking how slowly this fantasy goes by the roadside. Do you know what I mean? So they ask her every day, like, how's your shorthand course going, Mom? How's this? Because her whole thing was like, I have no skills.
Yeah.
Like I was only taught how to be a beautiful woman. That's all I can do. And it's just, it's so heartbreaking. And she's like, just obviously stops going or perhaps never went at all.
Mm-hmm.
And they're holding on to it. They're like, how about your shorthand though? Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's one part where they're like, how long does it take to become a really great secretary, Mom? And she goes, I don't know, a month.
I forgot that. But it's classic gaslighting.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a real book about abuse and how they believe in her for as long as they possibly can, which is something that, you know, that's the truth about child abuse, I think.
Yeah.
That they want to believe that their mother is a good person. And it takes a very long time to really realize. And, you know, and they could have escaped at any point. And it's only the irrevocable proof that she is a bad person that makes them leave.
Yeah, that's so true.
They wait until the last possible moment when they just cannot put up with any more from her, and then they go. But the other thing you were talking about how the women are motivated by, you know, money and power, but yet Corinne has nothing, can't do anything to get this money and power. It's a little bit of a lesson in there, you know, for the readers, the female readers of the book. Really, guys, you got to get some marketable skills.
Yeah.
Because
it's never
going to
be enough.
Just being a beautiful woman who everybody looks after is just not going to be enough.
Yeah, there is definitely like a kind of a proto-feminist vibe going on in there. Which
buried
is buried super deep.
But yeah, with the women having all the power and being the bad guys and having all the agency.
Yeah.
But also, you know, don't marry your brother.
should we quickly summarize what happens in these sequels?
I don't know. I can't remember. I read them all, but I've forgotten them. And to be honest, I forgot that Corey died when I had
really.
Read this. I only remembered the incest.
He's not a very strong character. You can kind of forget he exists at all. But yeah, to summarize, they do. They leave the attic. They are adopted by a nice rich doctor who Kathy later marries. Okay. And then they basically spend their entire lives trying to fight the fact that they are irrevocably changed and cannot be normal. They will never be normal. He's a doctor. She's a dancer. Carrie goes to like a boarding school and is bullied for never being able to grow past like 4 foot 10 kind of thing. She's basically chased very, very short her whole life and doesn't develop as a woman typically does. And they have to fight this sort of scar of their lives, this whole thing. And then eventually they basically give in, move to California and live as husband and wife.
After Carrie's dead.
After Carrie is dead. Carrie dies too.
Killing herself. Oh my God, she kills herself with the same
arsenic
that she killed does. Her brother, Corey.
So, it's very interesting. The prose style in Flowers in the Attic is weird. It is among the oddest prose you'll ever read. It's
very gothic novel.
Yeah.
Very gothic novel with all the exclamation points, the heightened language, the sort of fairy tale imagery. Everything is hyper gendered, which happens in gothic novels. So the men are, strong. I mean, they're all idiots, right? And they do nothing, but they're all strong and prince-like, and the women are all fantastically beautiful or crones.
There is no average looking woman.
No. Child, maiden, or crone. That is it. And there's as I said, a lot of exclamation points. Everything is so exciting.
Yeah. Even when nothing's happening.
Yeah.
It's incredibly extreme. The way they talk to each other are not the way people talk to each other.
No.
You have to get used to that very early on if you're going to enjoy the novel. You're like, people don't talk normally to each other.
No. There's this one point where they're having this big party.
Yes.
For the father's birthday before he dies and the police walk in and they narrate how he died. Do you remember that?
Oh my God. Yeah, what is it? He's like.
And they say, well, this happened and he could have survived, but then this happened. And then he could have survived that. But then this happened. And everybody at the party is going, it is not. It's the language that. See, you don't have the soap operas here that we used to have
That's
in America,
the thing. It is
but it's soap opera language.
And it becomes more soap opera as the books go on. It becomes more, she's my daughter and my sister. the webs of incest become deeper and deeper as each book goes on. And it makes me so curious, for many reasons, about Virginia Andrews herself, of which, not that much is known.
Mm-hmm.
But what we do know about Virginia Andrews is that she was a wheelchair user from a very young age, and that she lived with her mother, and that she was writing a lot from, many people think, from the perspective of being someone who literally couldn't leave her parent, which I find very fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also interesting because the way disability is talked about in Flowers in the Attic is shocking even for the time, right?
Yes.
There's a sense of the children are perfect and beautiful.
Yes.
And if... They keep coming back to the thing, if we were truly incestuous spawn of the devil, we would be mentally or physically damaged, right?
Yes.
Which is a bonkers way to talk about disabled people
when
terrible. You yourself are disabled.
Yes.
What the heck? What is that about?
I can't even begin.
Yeah.
It's interesting because even in the sequels we're talking about, the cast of characters is quite small, relatively, because they're all related to each other.
When a new non-relative comes in, you're like, you're not going to last. You know what I mean?
They're all together. And then, talk about the name is Dollenganger, which is a cross between doll and doppelganger.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
They're all carbon copies of each other and all of that. So it's so confined, not just the setting, but the stories themselves.
And apparently the inspiration for this book came from because Virginia went to the hospital a lot for various spinal operations, etc. And apparently while she was at the hospital, which actually explains why there's so much fascination with doctors in the books as well.
Yeah.
She was told about these children that were discovered in an attic who were kept up there for 6 years because of it. So apparently it is inspired by a true story that we have no record of. It's completely
apocryphal.
Yes, but it actually, I think what maybe terrified me the most about this book when I first read it as a kid was it begins with this prologue where she says Every word I put down with tears, with bitter blood, with sour gall, well mixed and blended with shame and guilt. I thought I would never feel ashamed or guilty, that these were burdens for others to bear. Years have passed. I'm older and wiser now, accepting too. The rage that once stormed within me has simmered down so I can write, I hope, with truth and less hatred and prejudice than would have been a few years ago. Like Dickens, in this work of fiction, I will hide myself away behind a false name and live in fake places and pray to God that those who should will hurt when they read what I have to say. It feels, obviously, now if I pick that up, I'd be like, oh, that's, of course, you know, that's just the author creating a thing, right? Mm-hmm. But my 12-year-old brain was like, oh my God, it's real. It's all real. This yeah. is real. And I think that added a lot to the shock and the intrigue, right?
She uses that technique. In a way, it's a really traditional technique, as you say. But as you read it, you're like, oh, wow, did that really happen to her? Is she really looking back on it? And that's a nice little introduction that she's got there, because it gives you a perspective on it from, because all the way we're really stuck in this child's head. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the only places where we get lifted out of the child's head a little bit.
Yeah.
To see that she can see how weird it is what's going on later on, and that it's changed her forever, and that it's going to blight her life for the rest of it.
And also not from a perspective of like, when I remember my terrible youth, but everything's better now. Yeah. It's like, I am bitter and I write this out of revenge.
Revenge.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no quiet for her ever.
Yeah. This is a great... I think it might appeal to teenage girls, not just because of all the agency, but also because it's so powerful. This book is an act of revenge.
Yeah.
She was powerless during this book, but now she has the power and she's sort of pointing it back at the people who did it to her.
And it's such a fantasy, isn't it? Right?
Yeah.
Like that you can get like have this revenge on your teachers or your what the authority figures that you can't control, and all you have is the hope that one day you will rue the day.
But this was her debut novel.
No.
Wasn't it?
I didn't think it was.
I thought it was. Maybe it's not. But she wrote this one and all the sequels, and then she wrote My Sweet Audrina.
Yeah.
And then she died.
Yeah. And then they kept writing her books.
There have been 70-odd books since.
Yeah.
If you look at the beginning there. Written by a ghostwriter. I can't remember his name now.
His?
Yes.
Insult.
And, well, he's quite a well-known writer in his own right. So he also writes popular fiction under his own name as well and under this name.
Yeah.
An incredibly prolific man.
How do you feel about, like, I mean, it kind of lends to the sort of like gothic ghostly appeal of B.C. Andrews, right? That
she wrote 70 books after she died.
Yeah. How do you feel about it? I mean, because you've ghostwritten in the past, haven't you?
Not ghostwritten. I've written under a pseudonym.
Okay.
No, I don't think I could ghost. That takes putting your own self aside in a way that I would find really difficult.
Really?
But I do wonder, and I have not read any of the ghosted novels.
No, I don't see the point. Like, I'm only really interested in the Dahlengangers.
But I'd be interested in knowing if the men have no agency in them, like in this one.
And like every single cover is just like a woman with long hair looking over her shoulder being like,
And they're so blonde. So when I was the age when I wrote when I read this, I wanted to be blonde and have long hair and have blue eyes.
Oh, totally.
Perfect skin and be a dancer. Right. I'm a clumsy Jewish girl. And that was what I wanted, to the extent where we have three people in my family called Julie. My mother's sister is also called Julie.
That's very Dahlengänger.
That's quite Dahlengänger. And in order to differentiate us from each other, we both have brown hair, but I'm blonde Julie because I insisted so much when I was young that I was blonde.
That's so cute, Julie.
So I just put myself in there, and I did want to be Kathy in this book, even though she has such a horrible time of it and has all these unnatural desires. I really identified with her very, very strongly when I read this book.
She's got a lot of drawbacks, and in like her vanity, I remember being like, why does she like herself so much? I hate myself. But like she becomes like a mother figure to these kids, and she becomes a real responsible, quite level-headed person, and she has it's weird, she is kind of the queen of that kingdom, you know,
yeah,
that tiny horrible kingdom. Which was kind of appealing, you know, in a hideous way.
In a hideous way.
Yeah. Everything in this is appealing in a hideous way.
But, you know, so it's okay. It's okay to have things appealing in a hideous way.
Yeah.
I was really interested in your DM that you sent when we decided to talk about this book. When you're saying you'd spoken to a lot of queer women who identified with it because it was so aspirational and yet so not normal.
Right. I think there's a lot in that. I think that sense of because the whole it's all about having the wrong desire. That's what the book is about, right?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Feeling something and it feeling so natural to you and yet it is so unnatural to the people around you. And especially with these allusions to God all the time. God is rammed down their throats, and the more God is pressed on them, the harder they rebel against it, right? And I just think that is so much of the queer experience, right? Yeah. For a lot of people, you know?
It is. And I didn't realize that when I was reading it. Obviously, I really had no clue. But reading it now, I can see that very, very clearly. Yeah. I can see that now in my 12-year-old self.
Wow. Because above and beyond that, it's just so camp, you know?
It's really camp. Oh, my God. Heather Graham in the film.
Oh, my God. Heather. So there were many films. There was a film in the 80s made, and then it was remade for Lifetime very recently. And Heather Graham is basically like Joan Crawfording it out, right?
She is a drag queen.
She is a drag queen. I think it's the bulging eyes really help as well.
And I love Heather Graham. She is so beautiful. And she really looks horrible.
Oh my God, the old age makeup. Oh, is just something else. And Elaine Stritch as the grandmother. And she's a pretty big deal.
Amazing.
Yeah.
But I thought that was perfect casting because you're the sort of aging doll. But yes, very, very camp.
Right. In a way, though, like, I think those Lifetime movies made a pretty good stab at you know, adapting it. But I said to you before we started recording, I don't think you can adapt this because so much is reliant on the mood and the casting. Because I think casting directors just said, okay, we need four blonde kids who need to gradually get sick and also become completely perverted within, you know? And I don't think there's any teen actor who can pull that off. I think it needs to be like an animation. I would love to see it, like, get a Studio Ghibli sort of effect, you know?
With all of that. Because it is it's a psycho story, right? It's a story of Kathy's mind.
Yeah.
And she's trapped in this attic, which is her mind. And so portraying it on a screen where you don't have that level of subjectivity would be very difficult to really get the full sort of force of the desires.
There's like the souring of this girl as well, you know?
Yeah.
You really need, unless you're going to have just a young woman shouting for 40 minutes. You
know? It's very difficult to get so into somebody's head in a film.
Yeah. So how would you see this ideally adapted? Would it be like a Wes Anderson sort of puppet Fantastic Mr. Fox thing? Or like a Studio Ghibli thing? Or a Pixar thing? Or like, imagine.
Animation would work really well because then you can use... I mean, have you seen Spider-Man Into Spider-Verse?
I haven't yet, no.
Oh, my God. So the thing about the animation is that it portrays a mood as well as a character. Mm-hmm. And so it can do things in really interesting ways. I think this would be very interesting and animated, but not Wes Anderson. He's too cold and quirky.
Yeah,
he's too
removed.
You need to get right inside and see how passionate it is. Oh, lots of red and black.
Right. I think I might have said Wes Anderson because I think that stop motion thing for the attic would have been quite interesting, you know?
They have a dollhouse in the book.
Yeah.
And they...
Of the house itself, am I right? Or is it just a very nice dollhouse?
I don't know.
That maybe becomes a symbol for
it. But it was her mother's, and I think it was her grandmother's before that. So it's been passed down through everything is passed down through the family in this book. So it's been passed down, and then Corey traps a mouse and feeds him. And so the mouse then becomes their trapped pet, like they're trapped
who
in
comes
the
to
attic.
Love them.
And then they kill him. They kill the mouse eventually with
they
the same
do.
Powdered donut that killed Corey. So they do the same thing to this poor mouse that their mother
but
did
to prove them. To themselves that this is indeed what is happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that mouse loves the dollhouse and runs around it. So wouldn't that be a great sort of visual image
God.
For everything that was going on? Wes Anderson would do that very well.
A great gif, you know?
Yeah.
I would delight to see that gif. Okay, Julie, I think we should probably start to wrap up now, but I'd love to hear about what you're working on. And you just had a book that came out yesterday, I believe.
Thursday.
Thursday.
Yeah, very recently.
Tell me a little about that. Does anyone fuck their brother?
Not in that one, no.
Not in that one.
No, it's called Louis and Louise, and it's one story about one person called Lou Alder, mm-hmm. Who was born in 1978 in Casablanca, Maine, mm-hmm. 1 year before this book came out.
Oh.
But it's two realities. So in one reality, Lou Alder is born male, mm-hmm. Louis Alder, and in one reality, Lou Alder is born female, Louise Alder. And because of that one change, everything else in their life is different. So the ripples of the gender that they're assigned at birth ripple out into their community, their family, their friends, and everywhere around. So it's one life lived twice is the tagline we've got.
That
on
sounds
the front.
Great. And can
Thank
I get that Waterstones, Foils, all the usual places?
Yes.
I can't wait to buy it. Thank you so much, Julie. This has been fab.
Thanks, Caroline. I've really enjoyed myself.
Don't poison yourself on the way out. Thank you for listening to another episode of Sentimental Garbage. Tune in next week when I'll be talking to Amy Jones about Joanne Harris's Chocolat. This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me about the podcast at ZaroLineO'Donoghue@gmail.com. Thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast produced by Hannah Varrell.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.